As with this morning, if you did not get one of the handouts, there are several laying around. If you would like one, Leo has some extra copies. You'd raise your hand if you'd like one of those. He'd bring around to you. There's several extra copies laying around, so you may not have to pass any around, but if you need some, they are available. Turn in your New Testament, if you will, to Galatians chapter 4. I'm going to meet you there in just a moment. Galatians chapter 4. One of the things as we study the Bible and grow in our faith, hopefully one of the things that fascinates us more, that we're amazed by more over time, is God's perfect timing. I think if we were to just take a survey and say, okay, who among us is patient and who among us is impatient, you would know by how we answer. Because the impatient people would be waiting to raise their hand before the question was done. Who's patient and right? And I would fall into the latter category, like I'm sure most of us probably will. We would say that whether it's overall or just with various things in our lives, a lot of us struggle with being impatient. And because of that, so many of us need to sort of step back and be amazed that even though at times it may seem that God works very, very slowly, that He always works exactly on the right time. Because the timing really is His. And I mention that tonight because our study deals in a lot of ways with time. This morning we began to look at the unfolding story of the Bible. We shared just a very quick overview of the entire Old Testament. If you weren't here, yes, the preacher preached the entire Old Testament in one sermon and did it in less than 30 minutes. But before, the natural thing to do then would be, well, let's just jump forward to the New Testament. But a lot of stuff happens between the close of the Old Testament narrative and the beginning verses of the New Testament. In virtually every copy of the Bible that I own or have or have seen, between the last page of Malachi and the first page of Matthew, there is either a page that's completely blank or a page that only contains a handful of words. Maybe something like the New Testament or the New Testament of Jesus Christ, and that's about it. It's about all it ever says. But do we realize that that one blank page, or mostly blank page, represents about 4 centuries of time? And we really consider those 4 centuries of time, it will help us to be even more amazed at our God's perfect timing. If you're in Galatians chapter 4, there's a phrase that's found in the middle of verse 4, or at the beginning of verse 4, that Paul says, when the fullness of time was come, or when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son. The word fullness in that verse means exactly what you think it means, but in the original language it had several different definitions. It was a very generic word, but it's interesting to think about the different definitions of that generic word, because in some ways they are all tied up together in the reason why Paul would choose that one term. The word can mean obviously something that was filled. Sometimes this word, by the way, was used of a boat that met capacity. It was filled to its seaworthy capacity. It was filled all the way up. The word also could mean abundance, filled to the overflowing. We might use it that way, maybe poetically, and that's the way they would have used it as well. But the word also could mean a fulfilling or a keeping. Something had been stated, and now it is coming true or has come true. Something has been anticipated, and now it is coming to pass, or has come to pass. It is fulfilled. All of those are included in that one term that Paul says, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son. As we mentioned this morning, chronologically speaking, the Old Testament basically ends with the book of Nehemiah. We mentioned how the other books basically fit in with the narrative leading up to that. But using just secular history, not just events in the book of Nehemiah, but secular history, we know that the events of that book end somewhere around 425 B.C. And the book of Nehemiah itself was probably penned no later than 400 B.C. Chronologically then, the New Testament begins with the birth and the ministry of John the Immerser. And that story picks up somewhere around 5 or 6 B.C. And so roughly 400 years passed between the close and the writing of the book of Nehemiah and the beginning of the birth and then of John and the birth of Jesus and the ministries that follow. And in that time, there is no revealed, or record I should say, message from heaven. There is nothing in the inspired text that we have. But If we take a look at what happened in that time frame, we will be amazed at God's timing. And so tonight, let's think about what happened in the fullness of time. And to do that, we're going to look at three basic things. You have them on the outline before you. We'll take just a few moments and consider world history. Don't worry. Yes, I majored in history in college. We won't be here forever. But we're going to think about some things that changed in world history that show this to be the fullness of time. Then we'll think about some things that changed specifically in the Jewish religion. There are a lot of things you read about in the New Testament pertaining to the Israelites or the Jews that you never read about in the Old Testament. But all of them show it was the perfect time. And then we'll make some applications. Is there anything in this history lesson that we can take for our lives today? First of all, consider some things from world history and turn to Daniel chapter 2. We're not going to discuss everything that happens in the entire world during this time, but we do need to notice that there were shifts that occurred, especially in the major powers around what we sometimes call the Bible lands. Interestingly, all of these are prophesied in the Old Testament. And so there's no problem with trying to figure out if this was God's will or not, or God's timing or not. He said these things were going to occur, and they happened just the way He said they would. In Daniel chapter 2, you have a prophecy that lays out what basically is a 30,000-foot view of what would occur between the time of Daniel and the time of Christ, the coming of the Messiah. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon at the time, you recall, has a dream, and it disturbed him. He must have thought there was some significance about that dream because he calls in all the wise people he can think of to say, tell me what this dream means. Of course, nobody can do it. And so, I guess as any king does, is that they can't figure it out, his solution is just kill all of them. That's a good way to take care of the problem, I guess. Until somebody says, there's one, Daniel. Maybe he can do this. And Daniel, of course, gives all the credit to God, but tells Nebuchadnezzar both the dream and the interpretation. If you're in Daniel 2, notice the dream itself, beginning in verse 31. You saw, O king, and behold a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of the image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them into pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image, it became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Daniel then goes on to interpret the dream. But instead of looking at every last piece of the interpretation, just take note of the fact that the first thing Daniel says as the interpretation is, you, O king, are the head of gold. When I read that, what my mind says is, start the clock. Because what he's saying is, you, Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire, you are first. You are this head of gold. And he even says that another kingdom is going to come and overtake you. But he says, it's not even going to be a kingdom as strong as you are. But somehow, it's going to overtake it. And so we know he's talking about successive kingdoms. History tells us who overtook the Babylonians, but we don't have to go outside of the Bible to find it either. Still in the book of Daniel, we're told that the Medo-Persian Empire, or the Medes and the Persians, overran Babylon. If you're still in Daniel, in chapter 5, you can notice the account where Nebuchadnezzar's offspring, Belshazzar, had that feast. And while he's having the feast, that finger comes and writes on the wall. One of those accounts in the Bible I really wish we had a videotape of. That'd be pretty remarkable. Mene, mene, tiku, ufarsin. What was the interpretation of that? God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought them to an end. You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. For your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians, verses 26 to 28. And verse 30 of Daniel 5 tells us, that very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius, or Darius the Mede, received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. As far as world history goes, the most important leader of that empire was Cyrus the Great. And if you study world history, you probably didn't spend much time on the Medes and Persians, because it didn't last all that long. But it's also interesting that you have Daniel, who had said, the kingdom that will overtake the Babylonians won't be all that strong anyway. And world history tells us, well, they were strong for a little while, but they weren't strong for all that long. They were in charge until about 332 B.C., when someone very, very strong came on the world scene. His name, of course, was Alexander the Great, who conquered what was considered the known world for the Macedonian, or better known to us as the Greek Empire. You recall the famous account, history tells us, or tradition tells us really, that Alexander actually wept because there was nothing left to conquer. But besides the fact that he was a great conqueror and overtook all kinds of lands, one of the things that the Greeks did, especially under his leadership, was not just spread Greek culture, but they spread the Greek language. More specifically, they spread what historians like to call Koine Greek. It was the language of the commoners and commerce. Koine Greek is one of the most specific and beautiful languages ever produced. The language was spread by Alexander, by others, so basically every common person would use it, whether it was their first language or not. They knew how to use this common language of the marketplace. Just after the first century AD, however, the use of that language began to die. And you think, well, why is that important? Because what was our New Testament written in? It was written in Koine Greek. So you have a language that's specific, you have a language that is beautiful, and you have a language, quite literally, that is dead. So we can go back and see exactly what was meant when Jesus said something, or Peter wrote something, or Paul wrote something, and it has not changed over time. But they weren't in charge when Jesus was born into this world. The fourth part of that statue, of course, is the great Roman Empire. Rome used many forces, military, cultural forces, to basically absorb the Greek Empire and make it even stronger. But one of the most important things Rome ever did was to build that great system of roads. All roads lead to Rome. And they used those for a postal system. Why do you think so much of our New Testament is written in letters or epistles? Because they could pass along the Roman roads to places like Thessalonica and Corinth and even Rome itself. But Rome also had the great want for peace, the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome. That was heralded. Of course, there were skirmishes all throughout the empire all the time. But the one thing Rome wanted, I guess more than anything except power itself, was peace. Remember the pushback at the time of the crucifixion of Jesus when Pilate saw there was a tumult building. That's part of what pushes his decision. But for most of his life, Jesus did the work in governmental peace. His struggle was with his own people, the Jews. For the most part, Paul and Peter and others were able to travel in peace. The struggle they often had was with their own people. But think with me for a moment. You have a time of relative peace in an absolutely huge empire, the largest at the time. You have a language that basically every person, especially every commoner, knew. You have a language that is exact in its expression as well as beautiful. You have a system of transportation that makes travel easier than it's ever been in the history of the world up to that time. You have a postal system that's reliable as anything that's ever happened up until that time. In the fullness of time, God sent forth His Son. You can make the argument that not just because it's God's time, because of world history, you can make the argument that there never was a better time for God to send forth His Son as far as the shifting sands of the world empires than exactly at the time when Jesus was brought into the world and when He ushered in the beginning of the church. But I want us to also take a moment and think about some changes in the Jewish religion. And we're not going to think about everything that changed, but there are some things that began to change or be emphasized or re-emphasized that you see a lot in the New Testament that you don't see as much in the Old Testament, but also that help us to grasp why certain things are taught by Christ, why certain things are written by the New Testament writers, and why they made such an impact. One change, ever notice you never read about Samaritans in the Old Testament? They are basically considered by Jews at that time to be half-breeds, dogs. You'll recall John would tell us the Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. The Samaritans, were those who had intermarried with nations that either had taken them captive or who occupied the land when the nation fell into sin. And so the fact that there were Samaritans was nothing new at the time of the New Testament. They've been around for a while. But what was new, what had grown, was the fact that Samaritans did not worship in Jerusalem. Remember John chapter 4? When Jesus talks to the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman, she has a question. Where are we supposed to worship? You worship on that mountain, Jerusalem. We worship here. We would know that as Gerizim. Which one's right? And you might remember that Jesus tells her, basically, if I may paraphrase, the Jews have it right on this one. But then he says, the time is coming when that's not going to matter. Where it's this mountain or that mountain, what's going to matter is worshiping God in spirit and in truth. But Jesus made sure that this group of people who were complete outcasts by the Jews, well, we still talk about the good Samaritan. Jesus made sure to challenge the thinking of many of the Jewish elites by reminding him that all people have souls, even the ones you might consider to be the lowest of the low. Another change in this time frame is our synagogues. In the Old Testament, you read so clearly about the construction of the tabernacle, and then later, this grand description of the building of the temple. As we mentioned this morning, of course, then the rebuilding of the temple in the time of Ezra. But you never read about synagogues until the New Testament. Historians say they basically began, at least in their concept, while the people were in exile and captivity. But they did not grow in prominence until this silent period, as it's sometimes called, the time between the Testaments. And hundreds of them were found all throughout the Bible lands. A synagogue was a place for Jews to come together to discuss their religion, provide training and teaching. But it was more than that. It was, in many ways, the center of their social lives. The ancient historian Philo called synagogues, quote, houses of instruction where the philosophy of the fathers and all manner of virtues were taught. The reason this was important is because the Jews began, in many ways, to reunite and refocus on the law of Moses. They didn't always agree on what it said, but they began to reunite on making sure they studied the law of Moses around these places of instruction. And so, it's no wonder then why you have Jesus and Paul and others so often going to synagogues. They would have had people who did not necessarily agree with what they said, but were willing to listen to a rabbi, a teacher, share something about the law. Then you have a change in a big fancy word. Some people say it's Septuagint. I believe it's actually pronounced Septuagint. All the word means is 70. The Septuagint is when the Old Testament, written in Hebrew, was translated into that Koine Greek language. It was done by 70 individuals, thus the name, in Alexandria, Egypt. And you say, well, this is just history. Who cares? It is remarkable. Those who study such things will tell us. It is remarkable how often Jesus, the apostles, and others quoted from this translation of the Old Testament instead of the actual original Hebrew. But even more than that, remember we said that Koine Greek was the language of the commoners. Now, the Old Testament, the words to the Jews we sometimes think about, everyone could read them and understand them, or at least hear them and understand them, because they've been translated into the language that everyone knew. And so you're introduced in the New Testament to a term you never see in the Old Testament, and that is the term proselytes, those who have been Gentiles, but who converted to Judaism, partially, not only because, but partially because they could hear the Scriptures in their own language. The most probably just history lesson of these changes was a revolt called the Seleucian Revolt. The Seleucians, or the Seleucidae, sometimes they're called, were a group of people who were totally bent on destroying Judaism, the worship of God. You may have heard in history class or a Bible class at some point the name of their most infamous leader, Antiochus Epiphanes IV. He not only killed Jews, but he dishonored them. His most infamous act was not just sprinkling blood in the temple in Jerusalem, but sprinkling pig's blood in the temple of Jerusalem. And the reason we mention this is because the Jews fought back under the leadership of a group of people called the Maccabees. One writer called the Maccabees priest patriots who were leaders in resisting their persecutors. And the Jews finally were able to overcome, and they were able to gain an independence to worship. The Romans did not mind the Jews' religion. And so the Jews had this freedom to be able to worship in relative peace. And this united them because they realized that they needed to be united again under the one true God. You ever noticed how often in the Old Testament you read about a problem of idolatry and how you never read about it again once the people come back from captivity, and how Jesus did not even address it in the New Testament? It's because the people, while they were in captivity, realized their problems. And while they fought these revolts, began to realize the only way to do this is to be united under God. And so they revolted, and they won. You also have the change of a growth of different groups, sects, they're sometimes called. When you read through Genesis through Malachi, you won't see words like Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, Zealots, Herodians. But you read about all of them in the New Testament. It's interesting that Jesus would point out false teachings to these groups who oppose one another, but then they would basically unite to try to get rid of Him. But the growth of these sects is important because they were fighting for power within the religion. And Jesus exposed them for that. He exposed them for their lack of heart in their religion because all they cared about was their way of doing things. I shouldn't say all they cared about. The main thing they cared about was their way of doing things and seeking the praise of men more than the praise of God. And then you have the change of a group called the Sanhedrin. Basically, the Supreme Court of the Jews. 70 leaders, Sanhedrin, plus the current high priest, so 71 people, made up a council who were able to make decisions concerning the religious dealings of the Jews. Now sadly, the high priest, by the time you come to the New Testament, was basically nothing more than a puppet leader for Rome. But the group figures so prominently in the life of Jesus and the apostles because they had to try to figure out in their mind what to do with this rogue rabbi and these rogue followers of his. There are other changes that occurred, of course. The Jews largely became commercial traders instead of farmers and herdsmen, and that figures into a lot of what we read in the New Testament. But these are enough to show us that the time was just right. Though a lot was wrong with some of these things, you shouldn't have all the division and those sorts of things. You do have a time where the Jews are going through a time of great scholarship and study. They are at least united on the fact that there is one God. Isn't that one of the main things they pushed against Jesus for? He made Himself equal with God in the fullness of time. God sent forth His Son. And some of you are sitting here thinking, I got out on a Sunday night to go to a history class. I can do that in school. I can take an online class or something. What in the world can we learn from all of this? I want to give you three applications. You have them listed on your handout, but I want to expand on them a little bit more. If we don't gain anything else from this, let's take these three points of application. Number one, God is in control of history. When Daniel stood before Nebuchadnezzar all the way back in the time of the Babylonians, there basically was probably not a soul alive who thought that Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom would fall. Even if Nebuchadnezzar died, people thought that kingdom would just stand. And they for sure did not think that any kingdom that could possibly take over his kingdom would ever fall. But God knew all along what was going on, and He knew just what would happen, and He knew just when it would happen. Sometimes you and I look at world events and we are just flabbergasted. We can't believe that a certain dictator continues to hold control, or a certain military coup occurs, or whatever it is. We struggle to see how an anti-God mindset can continue to be pushed upon people throughout the years. And sometimes we wonder, is God really still in control? And the absolute answer from studying this period of history is, He is always in control. Proverbs 21 and verse 1 says, "The king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever He wills." And even in Nebuchadnezzar said, in Daniel 4:32, "The Most High rules in the kingdom of men, and He gives it to whomever He wills." We have to remember that God knows just what is going on, and that God is still on His throne. Yes, we need to be concerned with the world in which we live, and know the times, and know what's going on, but we don't need to think that God has lost control. God is always in control of history. Number two, the most obvious takeaway is God's timing is perfect. In the fullness of time. 400 years pass from the end of the narrative of the Old Testament to the beginning of the narrative of the New Testament. Why, if you let me use the terminology, why was God quote-unquote silent for that time? Because that's exactly the time that was needed for the message to wake people up. You and I sometimes may not understand why things go the way they do, why things go on the way they do, why sometimes things go slowly, why sometimes things may seem to be rushed. But God's timetable is not our timetable. To me, it's significant how often we are told in the Bible to wait on God, or to wait on the Lord, or to wait for the Lord to act. And how rarely, basically never, we are told to hurry up for God. Maybe He knows people like me. But it's a test of our trust in Him. And it's not to say that we're not to work. But what it does mean is that we continue to seek His guidance and make sure that we're not trying to run ahead of Him, realizing all along His timing is perfect, even if I don't understand it. And so tied to that, number three, we are in, if you will, if you please, a silent period, but God's timetable is still perfect. Here's what I mean. Jude verse 3 tells us that the faith has been once for all delivered to the saints. 1 Corinthians chapters 12, 13, and 14 remind us that there was an age of miracles, a time of miracles, but when the perfect is come, those miracles He put away with. In other words, when the Bible is finished, there's no need for that. The Bible's done. God is not going to send another prophet. God is not going to send another inspiration. God's not going to send another testament to us. We're not going to hear Him peel back the clouds and give us another revelation. He's not going to drop some stones like He did for Moses. Those things are just not going to happen anymore. It was a long time ago when the last period was put on the end of the New Testament. In fact, almost five times as long as it was between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Does that mean that God has forgotten? Or does that mean that all of these promises no longer matter? No. Because there will be a day when God speaks again, not in the same way, not through the hands of inspiration, but it'll be a day through His Son when He calls all those who are living and dead to come forth, and He will judge the nations. The Jews were told through this prophecy in Daniel that during the days of these kings, God would set forth a kingdom. You'll notice the fact they were never told when during the days of those kings. They didn't know when during the Roman Empire Christ would come. And the Roman Empire stood for a long time. I say that to say this. We have absolutely no idea when Jesus will return. But I can also tell you this. Whenever it is, it will be the perfect time for Him to come, because it's the time that God has ordained for it to happen. And so we can't understand necessarily the timing of it, except to trust that God's timing continues to be just right. In the fullness of time, God sent forth His Son. As we close this lesson, let me ask, He has given you this time to prepare for the end of all time. And since none of us knows when the end of all time or the end of our time will be, why not make the most of this time and make sure you are ready to meet the author of all time? It may sound like a history lesson, but it's really far more than that. It's a reminder of the one we serve really being in control of everything. Is He the Lord and Master of your life?